Hey guys, it's your host Julian. This week I'm sitting down with King of the Hill writer Michael Jamin to talk all things King of the Hill and his new book, A Paper Orchestra. I cannot recommend Michael's book enough. Check the show notes below and grab a signed copy from Michael. I want to give a special shout out to a couple of our patrons that help make this podcast possible. Bill, Brent, Brittany, Eight-Legged Bird, Jacob, Nick, and Patrick. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a patron and help support this show, check the show notes below and sign up today. Now, let's get on to my chat with Michael.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to What's My Head Podcast. I'm Julian. Today I'm joined by Michael. Michael, welcome to the show, man.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, man. So the fans out there know my absolute love for King of the Hill. I was raised on this show. This show informed me how to be an adult and how to be a young teenager, man. So taking a step back, how does Michael get on to King of the Hill?
I've been a writer for 28 years. And I started on a show called Just Shoot Me with my writing partner. We wrote on that. And then our agent, we were on Just Shoot Me for 4 years. And then King of the Hill made us a job offer. So we bounced on to King of the Hill.
How difficult is it in your industry? Is it easier to land a job when there's two of you, or is it easier when you're solo?
In theory, it's easier when you have a writing partner because it's basically two writers for the price of one, in theory. So, mm-hmm.
I got you. Now, when you're on King of the Hill, obviously you were just coming from Just Shoot Me, you had said. Yeah. How did you find out about King of the Hill? Were you a fan of the show prior and then just something popped up and you wanted to apply?
No, I mean, I remember Just Shoot Me was just on, and I think King of the Hill was on opposite us in the time slot. And I remember watching an episode where Bobby falls in love with like a mannequin head. And I remember thinking, oh my God, this is really a good show. And I was like, we're in trouble. But then we wound up moving time slots. And so we were not up against King of the Hill, but for a minute we were. But then, what happens is, so our contract was up at Just Shoot Me. And so at that point, as negotiating leverage, your agent takes you out to other shows and who was interested. And so King of the Hill was interested in us. And that was just, it was negotiating tactic, but we're like, you know what? This is a really good show. Why don't we just jump on it? Instead of messing around, why don't we just jump on it?
Right on. So what's that? Obviously, there's a lot of similarities in the subtle humor, David Spade being in that one, with Just Shoot Me, and then Mike Judge's sensibility and humor with Greg Daniels and King of the Hill. Mm-hmm. Is it hard switching gears from obviously live action to animation for you?
No, not really. I mean, people think it is. It's just, writing is writing. I write scripts. I don't really care if you animated it or shoot it with live people, but it's none of my business, however you want to shoot it.
I like that. I've had a lot of the directors on and a couple board artists, background artists, and they always start out with the pencil test. How is a writer coming on the show? Do you guys have some form of a test to see if you can write the scripts?
Well, they want to read your writing samples. So you have to have writing samples that they think could match the tone of your show.
Oh, you so know? They won't give you like Bobby does this or Peggy
this. No. You just read read your writing samples. And that's it.
Got you. Now, when you're starting to, when you guys get hired and you're starting to, get knee deep in King of the Hill, what are some of the things that you're doing to, assimilate to the King of the Hill? Are you guys going anywhere trying to figure out what mm-hmm. Texan lifestyle is? How does that work for you?
We took a road trip to Texas to absorb the culture. The whole staff, we went. They went every handful of times. Mm-hmm. Many of the writers on King of the Hill were from Texas. So if you had a question about the culture, you just ask them, And so and they help bring the authenticity to the... But that's not... the stories are human emotions. They're just human. They're humans. And so you just pepper it in with some Texas culture.
What do you latch onto for a story? Is it the heart? Is it the motivation of these characters? What drives Michael to write?
Well, to write for television, you mean?
Well, we'll do both. Television, if it's different than the King of the Hill answer.
Yeah. Well, for TV as a whole, you're just trying to come up with a story that can engage people for 22 minutes. And mm-hmm. And that means there has to be some kind of emotional, the stakes have to be high. There has to be emotion attached to the story. And then you're pitching it to the boss. And then you'll pitch five ideas to the boss, the showrunner. And the showrunner will say, that one, that's the one we're going to work on.
Gotcha. And so I told you before we hit record, man, I found you. It was probably last year, it was right during the strike. And you were on Instagram all the time. And the first video I see, I don't know how it popped up into my feed. It was probably, I was just searching King of the Hill. You might've had a King of the Hill video out there, but it was, you went after a troll essentially. I can't remember the context of the whole thing, but I remember I'm outside, I'm smoking a joint, and then I'm in tears, laughing my ass off of you just eviscerating this guy. Now,
I have mixed feelings about doing that, by the way. I'm not
sure
if I should.
Yeah, people are crazy.
People are crazy, right? Crazy. Yeah. So I just felt like, well, I am a comedy writer. Like, I can do this. I know how to weaponize words. I can make it funny, but then again, people are crazy. So
getting it back to your writing, and ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about Michael's book here very shortly, Paper Orchestra, but I wanted to bring it up for just a second because it kind of goes into this question. It was probably the first couple chapters of your book, and I don't know how much you want to give away from the book, but there's three parts of your book that I found absolutely left me in awe. I had to go back and reread it a couple times, and I was just blown away each time because I would pick up different details like most people do when you go back and look. The one where you were talking, no, thank you, when you were talking about your, I think it was judo, right? Was what what your dad and your mom put you into. Now, I found this extremely fascinating because my oldest son does Kenpo karate, and he does the whole fighting and sparring every other weekend. We've got a tournament we're going to, and it's, I don't know what it's like as a parent for your parents were going through, but I got to imagine it's probably the same, just watching somebody else hit your kid, watching somebody, oh, for sakes, I'm going to edit that one out. Watching something like that happen, I just, stressful, right? So reading your account for judo, you know, you felt like a fish out of water. You did not belong is the sense that I was getting it from. Now, equating that into an episode you wrote for King of the Hill, it was the Witches of East Ireland. Obviously, throughout the entire series, the whole running thing is Hank doesn't understand the generation. He doesn't understand Bobby. Did any of that judo, karate, did any of that influence the writing for this episode?
Not really. I got to say no. So, you know, that's, I almost forgotten all about that judo story until I wrote the book. And so when we were writing The Witches of East Ireland, we were coming with ideas, and I'm in my office with my writing partner. We're just bouncing ideas off each other. And he said, what if Bobby was a Wiccan? And I said, what's that? And he said, years ago, he dated a girl whose mother was a Wiccan. And he goes, you know, that means she's a witch. I go, wait, what do you mean she's a witch? And so he explained to me, like, always, did she think she had powers? She knew she didn't have powers, but she'd like to pretend she did. And I was like, I'm all ears. Tell me more.
Crazy.
Because I'm like, this is fascinating. And so that kind of became the basis of what the Wiccans of East Ireland. And the funny thing is about that, we needed a character name for the villain, like the main Wiccan, the main guy. And we're like, what's a good name for kind of a loser, kind of a douche? And just as we're saying it, the PA who gets us lunch, he comes in, and his name was Ward Rackley. And we're like, Ward Rackley. And we go, Ward, and Ward is a great guy. We go, Ward, is it okay if we name this character, this loser after you? And Ward was like, absolutely, I love it. So that's what we named the character. And Ward, you know, he thought he was honored.
I got to imagine, dude. So, like I said, this show means so much to me, man. This is a security blanket when I deployed. And you have top five lines in here. I don't know if you'll remember it, but when Bobby finally gets pulled out by Hank and he's going, you know, essentially, thanks for not letting me get my ass kicked, right?
Yeah.
He's in there and he's explaining to Bobby that he's, you know, that Ward's probably going to die with his mom, and then, or he's living with his mom until she dies.
Yeah.
And then probably a couple weeks after. You know, that was such a fun line. Do you know who might have wrote that, you or your partner? I know it's a tough question to ask.
I don't, you know, we wrote this episode 20 something years ago. Yeah. I want to give my credit to my partner. But you know, honestly, I want to say it's him, but very often we take credit for each other's lines because we forget. Yeah. You know, it's very possible, like often that, like he'll pitch a joke and I laugh so hard I go, that I think it's mine, and vice versa, probably. So I don't know. It's probably his, though.
Well, with you guys, is he the only writing partner you've ever had?
Yeah, we've been writing together for 30 something years.
Got you. And when you're looking for a writing partner, when you find a writing partner, is it easier to go, or not easier, because I'm sure it is. Is it better for you if you guys have not so much a yin and a yang, but you guys have different? Are you guys similar is what I'm getting at when it comes to comedy writing and all that other stuff?
Well, a partnership is really like a marriage. I mean, your marriages have to work, and it's not uncommon for partnerships to dissolve because they just don't get along, or at some point. In the beginning, we had different skill sets and different tastes, but over the years, we've really developed, very similar tastes and skills, and so much so that when we're giving notes, we each get like we'll work on someone else's script. And I'm writing notes and he's writing notes. And we have so much overlap in the notes. I feel the same way that he's feeling because over the years, we've kind of developed this kind of style of what we aspire to do when we write. And so that's kind of the nice thing. So, which means there's a lot less fighting over stuff where like, yeah, that's do it that way.
Now, when you guys are writing these episodes in particular, do you guys like to, every person I've talked to, I think you're probably the first writer I've actually had on from King of the Hill. Now, mm-hmm. when I talk to the artist, they get your script and then they work off of your script. The art comes mm-hmm. from you guys' script. Right. Now, since you guys are a partner, are you guys in the entire writing room just pitching ideas? Do they give you an idea or a title for an episode and do they say, some stuff? Or
no, your job as a writer is to come up with episode ideas and you pitch it to the boss and say that's, there might be something there. And then you'll spend a week or so trying to figure out what the story is. And then, we come up with the ideas. Occasionally the boss will say, I was driving home last night and the idea hit me, who wants to write it? And I'll do it.
Gotcha. Now for you in particular, when you guys have an episode that you're writing, it's already been lit as far as the sense of go ahead and write this. This has got it's got something to it. Do you like starting at the beginning, the middle, the end? Do you like starting with a specific key moment in the episode and working your way forward backwards from that?
You always start from the beginning. I mean, because I shouldn't say you always. It happens. I suppose it could happen a number of ways, but we'll talk about an idea and then we'll talk about, what can we build to? What's a potential second act break? So it's very amorphous in the beginning. And you're kind of filling in things and trying to figure out how the story works and how it feels. But typically we'll start, this is like upper level writing, but we will start with the first act break. This is what the first act break is. Let's go from there.
Now
it's kind of the beginning.
Do you feel like do you like to open more of the episode? Do you like to close it? Do you like to tie everything together? How does that marriage that you and Sievert have work when it comes to an episode?
Well, we sit at the computer at the same time. We have one computer and two monitors. So one of us will type and the other one stare off into space and zone out. so it's like, are you paying attention? No.
It's like going to driving school and somebody else has the brake is what you're saying. Well, they have the gas in a sense.
I mean, part of the fun of having a writing partner is that you don't have to concentrate entirely all the time. You can let someone else do it.
There's a story in your book that I really enjoyed that you were staring off into space when you were pitching yourself to get hired. Mm-hmm. And then Sievert came up with an elaborate story and then that striked your curiosity. You tuned in. I like I said, I ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get to that book in just a second. I love this book.
Thank you.
So when you're writing these episodes, obviously, all the artists have characters that were very difficult, very easy to write for, draw. And the one that came up the most was Bobby was the hardest one to draw for. He had the most heart in the entire series, but he was one of the most difficult to start because that head was very weird. It was very hard to turn him in three-dimensional space, right? So Cotton was the same thing, and it wasn't until I had Glenn Dion, and he said, Bobby is a mix between Hank and Bobby, or excuse me, Cotton and Hank. So you would just take Bobby, make him a little bit older and put some of Hank's sensibilities, his sternness in him. And then you would take him and everybody always drew him wrong. And they said, draw him like he was still 6'4", because that's what Cotton was before he had his shins blown off, but draw him like he was in a hole. And that's how all the artists really got to
in a hole.
Yeah. You would draw a picture Cotton in a hole. So he's still 6'4", right? But you would draw him like if he was dropped down, what was it, fucking almost a foot. And that's how people could get around the notions, because the anatomical process, they would say, was really, really difficult. So he broke it out and that's how he did it. Was there any things like that for the writing side that you guys would do to help with the character flesh out? Or was there any characters hard to write for?
Well, you know, I will say this before I answer that. We took a tour one day of the animators, because the animators would work in a separate building. They were subcontractors, so we didn't really interact too much with them. But one day we took a tour to the animation studio. I don't think they were there. Maybe they were on lunch or I don't know what. And I was shocked by how many, they have these cubbies, cubicles, and I was shocked by how many new drawings they had of every single character. I was like, oh my God, you guys are so sick. They were so sick. And it was like, oh, I loved it. I loved the fact that they were, you know, the like pinups of Peggy and like Hank.
All right, as we take a pause for the cause, if you haven't yet, you should check us out on all social media platforms by searching at In My Head Pod. There you can see who we've got coming on, and if you feel so inclined to, you could submit a question to be asked. Now, let's get back to the show.
Like having sex, and it was just so funny. And I what I loved about it was not that how perverted it was, although that was funny. I just loved that they were really these characters. They felt such a closeness to these characters that they could treat them like that, which I was like, wow, they have a whole backstory to these characters that I'm not even aware of, which I loved.
They've got their own fan
like
fiction. Hang,
you know, like, yeah, like someone's got a tiny dick. I like, wow, that's not my mind, but I'm glad it's in your mind.
So since we're talking tiny dicks here, Michael, yeah. I figured you broached the subject and I figured we can go down this rabbit hole just a little bit. Who had the tiniest of the tiniest?
Who had the tiniest? Peggy.
Jesus.
You did not see that coming.
No, I didn't. No. I mean, neither did anybody else walking by that tiny winger. So speaking of Peggy for just a second, I didn't know this because, like I said, I love all of these characters for different reasons, but there's a huge portion of the fan base that absolutely just despise Peggy. Did you see that in the writer's room whatsoever? Not so much with Peggy, but with a specific character. Or did you guys hate writing for Peggy?
No, we love Peggy. The problem, the thing is, the struggle with Peggy is how do you make this character, it's very typical back then. It was like, you have all these, for a female character, not to make her the straight woman. And just like, because everyone, you need a straight man in a show. And like Marge is very, Marge Simpson's not a fun character to write for. Homer's the funny one, right? Mm-hmm. And so is Bart. And so when you're writing for these characters, I think the temptation was to make Peggy, a straight woman, but isn't it more fun to, how can we give her something that's fun? And so that turned into, well, let's make her a know-it-all, because know-it-alls they're vulnerable. We know they don't know it all, but that's their weakness, but that makes them fun, makes them funny. And so know-it-alls, I guess, slowly turned into, you know, insufferable know-it-all for some people. But I was always very sympathetic to Peggy. She has a good heart and she's just insecure. That's all, you know, she's insecure. Yes.
She's that piece of everybody that's one of us that we always try to deny. You always hate what you see in yourself, at least something along those lines.
So I don't think the writers hated Peggy. I don't think we definitely didn't want anybody to hate Peggy. We're just trying to make her funny and human.
Now, did like I said, there's two things that I've learned from doing this podcast by watching the show for the last 25-ish years. I'm 34, so yeah. Some I didn't do too well in math in high school, Michael.
Oh, I got Dale over here, by the way. If you want to see Dale Gribble smoking a cigarette,
oh, absolutely, bring him on.
Okay, here, Dale, say something. Hank, conspiracy. There you go. So he's always, God, is he dusty? Dusty Shackelford. Okay.
Oh,
ice. All right.
Bravo. Since we're showing King of the Hill stuff. I'll show you this. I was sent this a little coffee mug by Ian Wilcox's brother. Ian Wilcox was a background guy, background painter, excuse me, and a background artist. He passed away last year. And they've heard every time I do, I've actually forgot to tell you this portion of the show, because we'll talk about the people you've worked with. And, you know, I know you guys didn't get to work so much with the animators the artists, the directors and everything like that.
The directors would come to the table read, but we wouldn't, you know, we'd give them notes, but they were in a different building.
Yeah, so Ian was a very big fixture in that side of the production process, and he was the guy that everybody loved to be around, make fun of, joke with, and everything like that. He was just this charismatic person that, like I said, everybody loved. And you know, his brother heard some of the episodes I did, and we did this. Everybody would tell a story about Ian, so everybody had a story about Ian. And then he was like, "Hey, I'd like to send you something." And he actually sent me his coffee mug, which you know,
that's sweet.
Got my eyes, got my eyes a little misty, you know. But speaking of of old Rusty Shackelford, you know. Obviously, Johnny is no longer here. And one of the videos that I saw of you, you gave him, or well, the writer's room had already given him a nickname, but he was called Johnny Two Checks. I love
Johnny
this
Two
video.
Checks. Yeah.
Johnny Two Checks, man. And Michael, I got to imagine it was Michael Two Checks as well, because you voiced, I think you voiced one character in here.
Yeah,
you
did... only once. Now, Johnny did it every episode. I just did it once. So. Yeah.
Do you have any fun stories about writing? Did you get to interact with him on the writing side at all?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I joined the staff, he was a writer, but then he slowly decided to leave the writing part and just became, he was a writer and a performer. And then when I, we had about a year overlap where we worked closely, and Johnny was a really good writer. But then he was, I guess he decided he was making too much money, and why get paid as a writer and an actor when I could just show up once a week as an actor and make a lot of money? I was like, and I felt bad because I like Johnny. Like, Johnny, don't go, because he was fun to be around. Everyone liked hanging around with Johnny. But he's like, yeah, but I don't really want to work as a writer anymore. So, yeah, but he was a lot of, everyone loved Johnny. He was a character.
So when you hear that name, Johnny Hardwick, is there a story that comes to mind, or is there a memory that comes to mind?
We, you know, we did a road trip to Austin. At that point, I think he was no longer a writer. He's just an actor. And, you know, we visited him at his house, and he had in Austin, and he had a teepee on the front lawn. I was like, wait, you had a teepee? He's like, yeah, man, get a teepee. Come smoke some weed. Like, and that was Johnny, man. He had like a teepee, like only Johnny would have a teepee in his lawn. And everyone loved him. I mean, like, it didn't even surprise us that he had a teepee. It was big. It was a real deal. You know, he just liked to mellow out, play the drums, or whatever the hell he's doing his TV.
Hey, man, there's something about having people call it fuck you money, man. There's something about having fuck you money where you can just wake up and do whatever it is your heart tells you to do.
Well, he didn't have kids either, so that helps.
It does, doesn't it, man? You know, last thing about Johnny, because I heard this from a couple different people on, you know, the behind the scenes DVD commentary things that they used to do. And they would say it was with Johnny, it was like he was the character of Dale, but he would slowly morph into that, where he became somewhat of a conspiracy guy, somewhat of this, somewhat of that.
I don't know. I don't know if that's true, but the character of Dale changed. You know, in the beginning, he's real angry, Hank.
Yeah.
And then he became more of a feckless kind of. You know, so he changed, Johnny changed the character, you know, of Dale. Yeah.
Do you remember any do's or don'ts specifically with Dale?
You know, there was someone, I saw someone post a video on TikTok where there's a theory that Dale knew that Joseph wasn't his son. And this is all a long con to get back at Nancy or John Redcorn. And I'm like, there's no way, no way, because what that story... That is a very sad, that story is sad. Dale's a conspiracy theorist, and he sees, it's funny that he sees conspiracy everywhere except for the one right in front of his face. That's funny. If Dale were to know that Joseph was not his son, then it's not funny, then it's sad. Then it's drama, it's not comedy anymore. And so, you know, there was never any question in my mind that, like, maybe Dale knew in the farthest reaches of his corner of his, you know, brain that Joseph wasn't his kid, but certainly not in this part.
That's we'll move on to the next thing, but that's another thing that you guys wrote so well. Whose fingers are closer, Hank? Mine or Khan's? That whole fucking scene where they're sitting here, I'm closer, I'm this much mad, and then he slaps him and jumps over the, well, he falls over the fence. It's anytime that character in Cotton was on the screen, man, I was having a good time. The other one you guys worked on was Yard She Blows, and this was obviously Winklebottom, right? Peggy is feeling like she doesn't contribute to the beautiful house, right? These neighbors are walking by, they see it, they tell Hank, and then she realizes, like, oh, shit, I don't know anything that we do here, right? Yeah. So she feels that that wanting to be wanted or wanting to be loved, and then she's feeling that inadequate feeling of not meeting that, right? So I loved this whole thing. The one thing that sticks out the most is obviously, you know, Bobby's out there. He's playing secret agent man. Frank's Winklebottom. Hank can't Thanks,
Hank throws his son under the bus.
Dude, not even just the bus. He threw him under the bus, ran him over, and then backed up and ran him back. That's my favorite out of these three episodes. Wow. That is my favorite scene in any of the episodes, was him burying him like it was a mob hit, running him over, and then he's like, no, I didn't finish the job. I'm going to reverse and then run him over for a third time. So it's a rule of three.
Yeah, that was funny. Yeah, because, you know, Hank, that's the genesis for that being a good story, is that, you know, Hank loves his wife, but he also loves his lawn. You know, now he's torn.
So. Absolutely, man. Now, right before we rotate into the book, man, you know, I've asked all the other guys this when they've come on. When you think of King of the Hill, your time writing on it, the people you're around, is there like one word, one phrase, one sentence, you know, one emotion that's evoked that comes to mind when you think of your time on King of the Hill or when you hear King of the Hill?
You know, I don't know if it's one word, but it's like, we were on a Just Shoot Me before that, which was a fun show. It's a blast. King of the Hill, in many ways, was less of a cartoon than Just Shoot Me, even though it was a cartoon. So when you wrote for King of the Hill, we're really trying to write real. And it was like writing a miniature movie. And writing King of the Hill kind of allowed my partner and I, after that, we felt we had the confidence to write movies. And we sold a couple of movies. We probably wouldn't have been able to do that had we not been on King of the Hill, because it teaches you that kind of small storytelling.
And then one more thing, if you could go back and relive any moment in your King of the Hill tenure, is there one that sticks out? Office party, writing a rap party, anything like that?
Well, I don't know. I went on about reliving, but for the first year we're there, the hours were really bad. So we would work sometimes till 4 a.m. And I would, like, it was rough. And I used to sit in the back of the room. We had a big writer's room, and maybe I'll do a post about this, but I sat in the same old chair with these big wooden pillars I'd sit in it. And then I would, you know, when you're working after midnight, you start losing your mind. And I would start poking at it with a thumbtack into the wooden. And I slowly started digging a hole into this pillar of the chair holding it up. And the other writers, they became hopeful, because they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm drilling a hole out of here. And then they were rooting for me. Like, go keep, and every day, and I'd slowly pick out, like Shawshank. And then when you finally get to the other side, I put a picture of Rita Hayworth, and then I had a toilet paper rope ladder getting out, and all the writers were rooting for me. No one was like, stop breaking the furniture. Everyone was like, keep digging, Chapman, keep going.
And there it goes.
It was a fun writing staff. I mean, everyone, like, there's a lot of really fun people on that show.
And there it goes. Andy Dufresne had to, walk through a mile of shit. Oh, man. Did you make it through to the other? Well, obviously you made it through to the other side, but did you ever get all the, did you bore through?
All the way through. And the hole was about this big. It was a big hole. It was good work.
Yeah.
It was good work.
Right on, man. So I figure we could rotate in the book. Like I told you before, man, I tend to stick when it comes to books. I'm a comic book guy. I still go get I got my stack of comics over here. I go get those every Wednesday. You know, when it comes to reading anything, it's typically World War II history or just history in general, man. I just love that type of stuff. I don't know why. It's just something that fascinates me. But, you know, when I saw you had your book out and I started reading it, I told you, man, first probably two pages, I was hooked. And I was, I don't know what it was. Well, I know what it was. It was great writing. You know, I'm not going to sit here and I'm not going to blow smoke. This one of the most, ladies and gentlemen, you got to go find this book. You can go on Michael, what's your website name? You know better than I do.
Yeah, michaeljammin.com/book if you want to get a signed copy, or if you go there's links where you can find it on Amazon or Barnes and Noble, and it's called A Paper Orchestra.
And those links will be in the description. Click them and you can go to wherever Michael wants you to go to, with books, podcasts, anything like that. This book was so fun. I'm going to start at the end, and then I guess we can kind of work from the beginning.
Sure.
You had a line in there, and I can't remember exactly where, so it might not have been the end, but, you know, you had thrown the idea out to your wife, like you wanted to write a book, you know, about you. And then she said something to the effect of, you should do it because you'll find yourself. I think that's, you know, surmise that topic, right? So do you feel like you felt yourself? As douchey as that question is that I just asked you, do you feel like you found yourself?
Absolutely. I mean, so all the stories they're true stories about little moments in my life. And I was trying to just piece it together. Like, why did I remember? They're all little memories. And so why did I remember? Some of them are really old. Why do I hang on to that little memory? Because I don't have a terrific memory. And so if I hung on to something, there had to be a reason why I remembered that. There had to be some emotional attachment to it. And then as I started digging into it, I'm thinking, why would I have said that as a child? Why would I have done that? And then I would think, you know, as a character, why would he do this? And sometimes I didn't know. And then I would think of other memories. And then patterns would form. And I'm like, oh, I'm starting to understand this little boy now, who was me, you know, years ago. But you just don't think of yourself that way. You live, and you don't really think of yourself as a character in your own show, which is what I basically am. And so at the end, I absolutely found myself. I figured out parts of myself that I just hadn't looked at in my entire life. And by doing this, I hope, you know, to tell your story as well. So you can, that's why I think you resonate. You go, oh yeah, I did that. I'm similar. Now I understand myself too, you know.
Now, did this feel like closure at all?
No, I don't know. I'm not sure if I just, to me, that's like a word that people use, closure. Yeah. I don't know. I still struggle with certain things. I don't really have closure over anything. It's just an acknowledgement of this thing that was lurking back in my corner of my you know, psyche. And now it's out in the open, but it's still there.
Is it hard to push that? Like, usually when there's something uncomfortable that we're all dealing with, it's you can push it back and push it back and push it back. And I found out you really can't do that when you like cannabis, right? Because everything that you've been repressing, hey man, remember you said we were going to think about this later. Now we're going to think about this for the rest of the night, and you're not going to get any sleep. So when you're going through this Rolodex essentially of your life, and you're looking at these core memories that you have, and like you said, you hadn't thought about some of these things in quite some time, were any of them kind of hard to like let go even after you wrote that chapter on it?
Let go in what way?
Like, so you have something and you can, like, sometimes you can prioritize certain thoughts, right? So you can prioritize sadness or anger or something like that. So I say something happens to me, I'm going to think about that later. I'm not going to really let that get under my skin. But when you have something like ripping off a Band-Aid, right? Letting air expose everything. You have a story like Alone. You have that out in the open now. You know you're dealing with that. You might have kind of left that back in maybe 2021 or 2022. It's now 2024. Is it hard to kind of put that back in its place where you can move past it and grow from any of your past experiences?
The thing is, regardless of, you know, we mentioned cannabis, but whether or not, and we all have stuff in our wounds, problems, things that we're not proud of, that we're not happy with. Most of us choose not to look at it. But not looking at it doesn't make it go away. It's still there, and it'll still affect your life whether you look at it or not. And so if you look at it, it loses some of its power, and you gain a little more agency over your life. So you feel like, you know, I can maybe write my own story as opposed to being a character that stories written about me in some way, you know.
Got you. So your main character vice an NPC. At least that's what I'm taking from it. You can kind of control your story.
A little bit like that, yeah.
Was one of the ones that I found really, really fascinating as well was not every time you would find any little bit of adversity or something was like not going your way, but you have these really big moments like a lot of kids do. Like my parents got divorced really young, you know, and when you were talking about your parents getting divorced, you know, you found football, right? A punter. Yeah. Of all things, it's like I look at all of these, I look at all of this like bios for you and reading just what you've done in your career. And the one thing I wasn't thinking was football punter. I don't know shit about football. If we're being, I know they punt it. I know they throw it. That's about basketball and sumo wrestling are the only two sports that I can get into. Weird.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. I can send you some clips. It's really cool shit, man. It's something to get into. It's very, very fun. But nonetheless, man, this is about you, not about me. With that one in particular, what was it like going back into that teenage mindset and thinking about that? Did anything come up that was different that you might have remembered?
It was really about, so the day that's a story about how I was a nerdy kid and I wanted to be something better than a nerd, and how I tried out for the football team as a punter just because I wanted to kick a ball far. And so that story is about a moment of grace where we all do something that's bigger than ourselves that we don't usually, like, if you're lucky, you get to experience a moment of grace once or twice in your lifetime. It's the grace, meaning like the hand of God giving you this power that you ordinarily wouldn't have. And so you, like, you do this thing that's larger than you, which is wonderful. But the day it happened, when I remember the day it happened, obviously, when I kicked that ball, in, you know, in college, like I didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't go back to my roommate and say, "You'll never believe what I did. I just kicked a ball really far." Like, yeah. No one's, so what? And so it's only when you put it in the context of a story and you take it all the way back to the beginning, to that day when I was like six or whatever, like then it becomes a story, you know? So at the moment when it happened, it really, there was almost nothing there. So that's why writing the book and figuring out these moments, how do I turn this little moment to a story? You get so much clarity over your life and you go, oh, that's who I am. I'm the kid who just wanted to experience a moment of grace, you know, and got it. Thankfully.
It was a beautiful story, you know, the whole book, but that chapter in particular, because,
Thank you. You
know, whenever you look at, you write this stuff for a living, so I'm not going to tell you, but I mean, you watch something and then sometimes there's these little hints thrown out there of like how something's going to end. Like, Oh, I've been following this show for the last 2 years. They're going really hard into this character's backstory. They're giving him some touch. He's getting ready to die at the end of this episode. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So the way I was reading it was, I was like, oh, is this going to be, he gets egg on his face at the end, but for you to be the hero at the end and you got to, I don't want to say scratch something off of your bucket list, but you got to find grace in something. Like I said, I just thought that whole moment, the payoff was really pretty.
Yeah. Thank you. And that, I mean, you know, you have a really insightful way of, you've given it a lot of thought, so I appreciate that. That's what I try to make all my stories. Like, if I'm taking you on a journey as a writer, like, why am I taking you to the end if there's not a good view? Like, what's the view of the story? What are we looking at now? And so that's what I try to build to at the end of all my stories. Like, what's the view?
How many stories do you think you crossed out before you settled on the ones that you wrote about?
Yeah. So there's 17 in the book, but I have several other that I'm saving for the next book. And I have a couple that I thought they're good, but they didn't fit tonally with the other stories. They just felt like they didn't match the tone. So I'm like, eh. And then several stories, the beginning ones were just not good enough to include. I go, that's some of them like, okay, I wrote the story and it's not, I don't like it. Like, it's not, if it's not good enough for me, it's not going in the book. So.
Which one was the hardest one to write about?
Well, emotionally, the hardest ones to write about were The Ghoul and Plague Upon Your House. But because it was just like, I was going there in terms of the truth, the hurtful truth.
And which one were those two? I'm sorry to interrupt. Which one were those two again?
The Ghoul and A Plague Upon Your House.
Okay.
So the last one, you know, that was about the pandemic. But in terms of difficult stories, like even Swing and a Miss, which is the story about taking dancing classes, like, my first draft that I gave to my wife on that, you know, whatever, first draft, fifth draft, whatever, it was early, you know, most of these stories have 40 drafts, but she read an early draft and it was about how I took dance lessons because my sister shamed me into being, she said, you're my bad dancer, you got to take dance lessons. And so I went, and what's interesting about these classes is like, it's people from all walks of life, all races, all income brackets, and people you wouldn't probably necessarily associate with because you just don't have the opportunity to. And now you're dancing, you're hugging them, you're dancing close, you're intimate with them practically. And so I wrote these, the first drafts were about them, the people in this class. And I thought, isn't it interesting, all these people? And my wife was, she was so bored by it. She goes, none of this is interesting, you know? And I'm like, it isn't? And so I didn't argue with her. I said, all right, that's not the story I should be telling them. So I went back and I tried to figure out, you know, is there something else I can talk about with these dance classes? And then I kind of, it hit me as I was just, I'm grasping at straws here. Like what can I write about that has something to do with dance? And at that time there was a woman that I was, you know, dating, I was seeing her briefly. And I went to pick her up at her house and she was very successful. She was a few years older than me and she was successful. And I was just like the phone boy. I had an assistant job and I would just answer the phones and I felt shitty about myself. But when I went to pick her up or go to her house, her apartment rather, I drove there. She was about a mile away, but I parked my car. I couldn't find a spot. So I parked it halfway between my apartment and her apartment. And I was just recalling that memory. I go, oh, that's what the story is about. This is a story about a person who's not yet a man, but no longer a boy. And so that's what the story is about, this awkward period in between when you're not a man yet and you're not a boy. Who are you?
You're on a side quest.
And that was a hard story to find. Like I said, if you were to read early drafts, it wouldn't even resemble the what was in the book.
Now, we don't have to get too personal. Does your wife write too?
No, but she was an actor. I met her. She was an actor I met on Just Shoot Me. And so she's a performer. She knows art, you know.
Were you taking, was that your sounding board for the entire book process?
Yeah. I mean, God bless, she read every single draft. And there, like I said, some of them are 40 drafts. She directed and produced the audiobook version of it. And this, I tour with this as a one-man show. She directs that because, you know, she loves it. She just loves it. She's very hands-on. But when I would give her a story, like, all I want to know is, did you enjoy it? Did you want to turn the page or not? And that's it. And sometimes she didn't. And when she didn't, I didn't argue with her. I just said, okay, I have to fix this.
You know? When did you know? I've always heard editing is like, it's not one of the hardest things, but it's one of the hardest things to like kill your kids or kill your babies type of thing whenever you're writing something. How hard was this to edit down?
See, that's the thing. That's the mark of an inexperienced writer. See, when you're in TV, you have to do so much rewriting that in the beginning, when you're starting off, oh, it's my favorite joke. And now it's like, man, who gives a crap? I'll write another one. It's not a big deal. So if something doesn't work, it's not, I don't feel like it's, the expression is, yes, kill your babies. I don't even feel that. I'm like, all right, get rid of it. I can come up with more. That's what I do. It's not a big deal. You know, the same way when you drop something on the floor, when you're cooking something and you drop it on the floor, you don't cry. You don't dust it off. I'll make another one. This is what I
Absolutely. Do. Absolutely. You know? Now, would you have that same sentiment at a 25-year-old, Michael?
No. When I was 25, everything was perfect. Everything I wrote had to make it on TV. And so, no, I mean, that comes with maturity. Yeah.
When do you think you finally learned that it's okay to punch something up or start over? You remember having that moment?
Well, you know, I was a writer on King of the Hill, and this something happened. We were, the showrunners had us, you know, I was in the room, there were three rooms. There was like the story room. There's a story room for a future episodes. That was the third room. So there's one room's working on this week's episode. Another is working on, you know, next week's episode. And then there was also a joke room where you would just, they'd say, hey, we need a line over here. Here's the script. We need a couple lines over here. And so I was just like, first couple weeks I was there. I was in the joke room. I'm trying to impress everybody. And we're struggling online. And I pitched something that hit it out of the park. Like everyone was like, they were roaring on this line. So I take this line the joke line, I took it into the showrunners. They were in one of the other rooms. I go, here, watch this. All right, here's a setup and a boom. And the joke, and everyone in the room roared. The showrunners, that's great. And they go, come up with five more. And I said, what do you mean five more? I just killed it. This joke is going to kill. They go, yeah, well, five more. And then I was mad about it. Right. And I went back to my office. I was fuming. I said, what's wrong with these assholes? This is the line. Everyone loves it. Right. But then I was like, but you know what? They are paying me a lot of money. So to write jokes. So fine, I will. So I was like, screw these assholes. I'll write 10 more jokes. And you know what? I wrote 10 more jokes and some of them were really good. I don't know if they were quite as good as that one, but a lot of them were really good. And after that, I was like, all of this is disposable. I just taught me a lesson, which was like, I can write more, you know, there's more.
That's a good lesson to learn, man.
Yeah.
Now with, obviously, back in the day, you guys were probably writing on paper. I know, you know, with my line of work, any recipe, any technique, anything our chef's saying, we're writing stuff down so that way we can refer back to it. And I used to have, I mean, I've got a little yellow notepad that I'm writing stuff down with now. But I mean, when I'm in the, perfect example right here, man, I've got like probably 15 or 20 of, you know, this style little book, little $5, $6 book of just nothing but recipes and stuff that I've had from the last 6 years or 7 years, whatever it's been, 6, 7 years I've been in the industry. Did you guys save, you know, any of those books that you guys wrote notes down? Was it always something you guys had to leave back? And
this is the book. It says composition, writing. I mean, it's like a fourth grade book, right? But yeah. I started keeping this when I was a young writer on Just Shoot Me. And I was sitting at the feet of really great writers and they would say smart things. And I was like, I just kept a list. Some of them Greg Daniels said, some of them, you know, other writers. And so I just kept notes. And so like I started, you know, at one point I started an online screenwriting course and I just opened this up and I just started here. Like, these are my private notes that I've kept from working, you know, sitting at the feet of really talented writers.
Well, that was my next question. Have you ever thought about putting that out there to the public or putting that into a book format so people could, like, writing by Stephen King is one of his best books.
And I don't know
if you'd thought something like that.
Oh, I've never even read that.
It's really good.
The thing is, I when the pandemic hit, I had a friend who was urging me to make a screenwriting course. I'm like, yeah, dude, I'm kind of busy. Then the pandemic hit, Hollywood shut down. And so I was like, all right, well, now I have time. And so I didn't make a book, but I made an online screenwriting course. And so if anyone's interested, it's still available. It's at michaeljammin.com/course. But so it's really just me. That's the funny thing is I haven't read Stephen King's book on writing. I haven't read any books on writing. Everything I've learned from other working writers. So
there's something about that on the job training that speaks loads. You know, you can learn a lot through a book, but through, you know, physical application of something, I don't think you really learn until you physically.
Oh, you learn so much just from people. I was so always blown away, especially on Just Shoot Me. These writers would watch a show over the weekend or a movie, and they'd say why it didn't work and what they would fix about it. I'm like, oh my God, that's exactly right. You know, how do you know? So.
All right, man, I got two more questions here. Sure. And then I figured we can end it. One of the chapters, and I meant to write this one down and I thought I had it in my phone, but I don't. What was the one, what was the name of the chapter where you go back to a love interest and you go to her house when you're an adult? What was the name of that chapter?
A Paper Orchestra. I named the book after that chapter. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I feel like I should have fucking known that one. That one was right on the nose, playing on the site. Michael, I failed you. I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
But that one got me thinking, you know, obviously we always have, you know, it's not so much that first lover, that person that, you know, you first get in contact with, you're like, oh, this is the one. That's what love does to you. It clouds your judgment in a bad way, but it takes hold of you like some virus. Yes. And it's like, this is the person I'm supposed to be with. Right. Mm-hmm. Now, what was it like? I can't watch extremely violent shows. I can't watch something that's very, very crazy because I feel bad for the person, even if it's not that I feel bad for Jeffrey Dahmer. I feel bad for the people that he killed, but I have this innate ability to like sponge onto the sadness that I'm seeing or the emotions. Like I have a hard time like letting that baggage go. That's not my baggage, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you're going into this chapter, this part of your life, and you're physically going to this lady's house and walking through and thinking like, could have this been us? You know, could that have been my kid?
Yeah.
What is that like mentally and emotionally? Obviously, you tell the emotional side, but mentally, I got to imagine like it's fucking wild to sit there and try to conceptualize this.
Well, that story, it's a true story. It's about me. Getting in touch with my old college girlfriend, this girl that I loved, who broke up with me and broke my heart. And so now 30 years later, or whatever, I meet up with her again and go to her house. So if we were in a writer's room on TV and I said, we're going to tell a story about that, about a guy meeting up with his ex-girlfriend, what's the first two storylines that people would pitch with? Oh, okay. So he's either going to murder her or they're going to have an affair. One or the other. Those are the two stories. Those are the only two versions, right? But what I like so much about the genre of personal essays is I didn't do either of those two things. I think the truth is more interesting. The truth is I wanted to see her and I wanted her to tell me something, but I wanted her to give me the answer of something. But I didn't want to have to ask the question. I wanted her to tell me without asking the question because I felt that would be cheating, right, in some way. And so the question that I wanted answered was, how did she remember me? Which is, I think, what we all want. How are we remembered by people who, like, was I just nothing to her? Was I like, what did she think about it all these years later? And so that's what I said to get out from that is just, and as I was there, I knew I was going to get a story out of this. So the whole time I'm there in her house, I'm being very conscious of, okay, how do I feel right now? How do I feel now? How do I feel? What's going on? What is she doing? And I'm constantly checking in with myself. It was like, it almost like out of body, but so that I could write about it later. And that's exactly what I was able to do.
So when you're going through this house with this lady, Obviously, I don't think you have a pen and paper and you're writing down all of this stuff. You're trying to stay in your head. So I got to imagine you're already pretty stressed out. The emotions are running high. You're already saying you're a super anxious person. So I got to imagine the anxiety is through the roof. I got to imagine your heartbeat going a mile a minute. So when you're in that fight or flight stage, very hard to sit here and try to be focused. And you're saying it's already an out of body experience. So you're already trying to grip onto anything. It's like Inception when he rolls that die. You're trying to grip onto any part of reality to make you tethered to this world, right?
Right.
How are you remembering everything? How are you feeling all of that go in and still retain it?
Well, I wasn't quite as anxious in that moment as maybe you think I was. I was, you know, I wasn't my heart wasn't racing. I was just more like, I just felt a little uncomfortable being there. And so I was just, I was just really trying to observe, and I was watching her, and I was just watching myself, but I guess I wasn't too panicked about it. But a lot of times when I'm writing, especially stories from the past, way in the past, like I may not remember all the dialogue, but I remember how I felt. And if I remember how I felt in that moment, I can easily fill in the dialogue. I know what I might have said. And and then it feels true because, you know, it's based in reality.
Is any of it like hearing a song and then being transported back in time to like, man, I remember when I was 16 and I heard, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit for the first time. Is it tied to that for you or?
Not so much, but I do know what you're talking about with music. Music can definitely take you back, as can smells. But smells, it was not so much like that, but yeah, I know what you're talking about.
You might have not been that anxious during that chapter, but I was anxious as hell during that chapter. I was like, what's going to happen? Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. Yeah. Like I said,
well, you know how there's a trick I did that, because the trick was up until I'm writing the past tense, but the minute I get to her house and I go inside, I switch to the present tense. Mm-hmm. And so what that allows me to do is now I'm living it with, as you are experiencing the reader and the author are going through it at the same time. So I did that intentionally to make you feel anxious, to make you feel like, because clearly when I'm writing in the past tense, we know it's, you know, I know I'm guiding you, but in the present tense, I'm learning it the same time you do. And so I think that makes you anxious, which is how I wanted it to come across. So thank you.
The weed didn't help either, because I would, like I said, I would just go smoking the weed didn't before help. I could.
I couldn't read like that, but okay. Yeah. I'd be distracted. Well,
I think that's why I have to go back and I reread and I highlight so many things. But like I said, if I can take it to 20 or 30 pages a night, you know, and I go, I'm not a slow reader, but I like going slow that way. If I ever, like I said, I read a lot of history, so I got to go back and remember this date, remember this, remember that, because everything ties into each other down the road. But like I said, that one chapter a night where I could just pace it out and I could really enjoy it, because there's a lot of times where it's like, all right, I operate really well on about 4.5 to 5 hours worth of sleep. That's my bread and butter. God. Wow. It's not like I want to sleep more, but I just, my body physically can't. I mean, 7.5 years in the military, and then you're working anywhere from 12 to 16 on and 12 to 8 off. You kind of get used to little to no sleep, right? So, you know, I've really, long story short, I fucking enjoyed your book, Michael. This was so fun. I really enjoyed the episodes of King of the Hill you worked on.
Thank you.
Before we sign off, do you remember that one joke that you absolutely killed with that you were talking about?
Oh, on King of the Hill?
Yeah.
I swear to God, I don't remember.
You'll remember right after we get off the call. It'll come to you.
No, the thing is, like, you know, people ask me about, like, what's my favorite joke? Like, I don't, like, when you, like I said, after I pitched it, I got a big laugh, but then I came up with 10 more or 9 more that were equally, you know, good. So, like, I don't remember it. It's all disposable. Like, the same way when you're making a dish, like, you know, you'll make more. It's like none of them are precious to you, because you'll come up with another one. And the newest one is the one you love the most, you know?
Sometimes, yes, there's two dishes you ever seen Ratatouille?
Sure.
So Ego, he eats that Ratatouille, he's transported back in time. There's two dishes in particular that every time I eat it, every time I see it, I think of my granny. And that's fried chicken and that's mac and cheese, because we grew up super Southern. Right. And those were the two dishes that you knew when they were on. Granny always put love into everything, right?
Well, that's comfort food.
Oh, it's a lot of comfort food, you know, and I feel comfortable gaining a little bit of weight when I think and eat the fried chicken and mac and cheese, you know. But whenever you saw those two dishes in particular, you know, you knew Granny put all of her heart, all of her love for you and all of her soul into that. And it's just, whenever I think of those two, those are the ones that, doesn't matter what kind of day I'm having, shittiest day in the world, best day in the world. It elevates it to a good day, and it just takes it even farther if it was a great day. You know what
I'm
I mean?
Sorry you can't make me a meal. I bet you can make a good meal.
Well, I tell you what, when we get off this call, if you're ever out in Florida, I'll tell you where to come at. So,
all right.
But like I said, Michael, I've had a blast. I've really been looking forward to this one. That's been in the works for, you know, since sometime last year. You didn't disappoint with your book or with you being here, man. It was a real blast getting to talk to you. Tell the folks where they can go and find the name of the book and then the website and whatever else you want to push.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So it's Michael Jamin. The book is called The Paper Orchestra, and you can find copies at michaeljamin.com/book. And you can also, you can find links. If you want a signed copy, you can get it there, but you can find links on there to take you to Audible if you want the audiobook, or Spotify or Apple. But you can also get the ebook or the paperback on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your indie booksellers, online everywhere.
Beautiful. And those links will be in the show notes in the description below. Well, Michael, like I said, man, this has been a real blast. I hope you had fun, because I know I had fun.
I loved it.
Throw this one for a little while.
I really appreciate all the thought and attention you brought into these, you know, reading the stories. It's I'm honored that you took that kind of time. So thank you.
Well, I mean, you took a lot more time writing this than I did reading it, man, because like I said, it's ladies and gentlemen, go pick this one up. I mean, Michael sent me a copy, but as soon as we're off this one, I'm going to go over to the website and buy a little signed copy, man. I'm going to put it right back there on that bookshelf. Well, there's a bookshelf over here, but there's another bookshelf over here. That's all my comic books, funny pages and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, he's been Michael. I've been Julian. This has been What's in My Head podcast, and this has been another piece of your childhood. Good night.
Thank you.
Hey guys, it's your resident cartoon junkie Brandon Jones here, asking you to have a listen to my Animation Destination podcast. It's an animation celebration podcast, and it's full of all sorts of stuff about anime and cartoons and voice acting and all that sort of thing, and just a really all-around celebration of anything animated. So come on by and check it out. We've got fan episodes of your favorite animes to your most obscure cartoons on Netflix that no one's ever heard of. And just really love talking about it. You can subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes and anywhere else you can get your podcasts from. So stop on by, subscribe, and stay tuned for the Animation Destination Podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we go, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with the podcast today. I truly appreciate every download and listen we get. If you're liking what we're doing, drop us a 5-star rating, drop us a review, tell a friend, and I'll see you next week.